Support for this program is brought to you by Genentech, the makers of Vabysmo, faricimab SVOA. There's more to explore. Discover all the data at Vabysmo-HCP.com. That's Vabysmo-HCP.com.
I'm Paul Hahn from NJ Retina. Welcome to this two-part mini-series on New Retina Radio titled AMD and DME Applications in the Retina Practice. I'm very pleased to be joined today by Durga Borkar from the Duke Eye Center.
Great to see you.
And Dr. Ted Lang from the Byers Eye Institute at Stanford.
Great to be here. Thanks.
Thanks for joining us. So today we're going to discuss a presentation that Dr. Lang gave at the 47th Macular Society meeting. So without further ado, I'll just turn it over to you, Ted. Why don't you tell us about this presentation?
Thank you so much for having me today, Paul, for Durga, for being here to discuss. We did this presentation at the Macular Society meeting this year, and that was really interesting because it was a new type of analysis that I think in the biostatistics world is done often, but in our field of retina hasn't really been explored that much. And that was to do what's called the systematic literature review and network meta-analysis of clinical trial data. So this is all data that's been, phase three RCT data that's out there. And, what the team did is was they took that data and compared it across trials. And, historically, we're always taught not to try to compare results from different trials, but this is actually a validated, statistically, significant way of looking at data from different trials to try to make some sort of conclusions that for us will hopefully be clinically meaningful. So that's kind of like the background about the methodology. But specifically what we looked at in this study was for diabetic macular edema. And as we all know, historically, anti-VEGF monotherapy has been the preferred first-line treatment for DME and AMD as well. And flexible dosing regimens such as Tretinixin and PRN, have been used to try to reduce treatment burn after the loading phase. More recently in the past 2+ years, faricimab, which is a bispecific for both anti-VEGF and anti-Ang2, has been on the market. And there have been multiple trials associated with faricimab. And, there is a potential through their mechanism for stabilization of the retinal vasculature. So our objective in this study was to evaluate the comparative efficacy, injection frequency, safety of the faricimab treat and extend modality compared to other anti-VEGFs and regimens. So we did this systematic literature review looking at different studies and assessed for visual acuity outcomes at 1 year, as well as a CST anatomic outcomes, injection frequency, and then all-cause discontinuations as our safety outcome. We whittled it down to 26 RCTs. And as the Yosemite and Ryan studies were unpublished during the study period, we went back to look at the actual study reports, but not the actual publications because they weren't out yet, just to be clear about this. And then to go more into detail about the statistical approach, the Bayesian approach assigns probabilities to the hypotheses. So for example, what is the probability of a specific outcome given the previous data? And the probabilities in this Bayesian statistics are then taken from prior distributions in the literature, which are the other studies we looked at. So in this analysis, we looked at the outcome of interest, and in the new information from the faricimab trials were then added to the prior distributions to then quantify the probability of interest. And in this case, we used the probability of faricimab at 1 year outcomes performing better than the other agents. And so, in the presentation, we actually showed a graphical depiction of each treatment modality as a node in a network. And so you can actually see kind of like a spider web like connection, interconnectedness. So if you say, for example, you had monthly Lucentis or ranibizumab in one treatment modality, that was used in multiple trials. And so there would be a different line from that hub and spoke to different trials. And then we would compare that to, faricimab every 4 weeks or aflibercept every 4 weeks and so forth and all down the line. So we create this web of interconnectedness where we compare to trials. So to dig into the actual results, what we did find that at 12 months with diabetic macular edema, we did find that the faricimab treat and extend modality was favorable And it was statistically significant, I guess you can say that, between that versus bevacizumab PRN, ranibizumab PRN, and ranibizumab treat and extend. And when we compare it to aflibercept 2 milligrams PRN, it did favor faricimab, but it wasn't, you know, fully statistically significantly better. And so, you know, I thought that was a really interesting outcome. When we looked at the anatomic outcomes at 1 year, the faricimab treat and extend was actually statistically significantly better than all four of those other treatment strategies that I mentioned just now. I'll go over one last result, which I thought was also very telling and interesting for faricimab versus other treatment strategies. And instead of the 1 year time point, we actually looked at the 12-week time point. And the reason why we looked at that was we wanted to make sure that everyone was getting the drug at the same interval. And so at 12 weeks in all these registered trials, everyone's getting monthly loading still in DME. And so we looked at faricimab 6 milligrams versus aflibercept 2 milligrams versus aflibercept 8 milligrams, which was also, you know, recently FDA approved for the treatment of DME. And this involved, you know, the Semi-Rhine, Photon, Tenaya, Lucerne, Pulsar, and Candela trials. And we did this Bayesian network meta-analysis of those as well. And I think, you know, the most interesting outcome of that comparison to me was that faricimab actually outperformed all the other treatment strategies, both aflibercept 2 milligrams and aflibercept 8 milligrams, both in terms of visual acuity outcomes, as well as anatomic outcomes. And the anatomic outcomes were actually statistically significant versus 2 milligrams of aflibercept and 8 milligrams of aflibercept, especially for diabetic macular edema, which, you know, I think a lot of us in the retinal community, we can get to this more in our discussion. You know, I think a priori would have thought that the 8 milligram of aflibercept would be superior, just, you know, given that it's four times the dose of our, you know, often favorite medication of aflibercept in use of diabetic macular edema. So I'll pause there and we can hear a little bit of reaction from Durga, but I think that was the main gist of our findings from the study. And just a quick note about the anatomic outcomes. In our study here, we looked at the central subfield thickness of the macula from OCT from all of these studies as the anatomic outcome.
Ted, what a great study. This really kind of gets at the heart of what we as retina specialists all want to know with so many new treatment options and how they all stack up against each other. Durga, what are your thoughts on this study?
I thought this was really interesting. It was really well done, you know, really advanced methodology that we don't always use in retina studies. So I appreciated that. I also thought it was interesting because, you know, I think it's going to be hard to get a head-to-head study with our newer agents for faricimab and aflibercept 8 milligrams. So I, you know, enjoyed seeing some of those results. I think that the network meta-analysis that they did in particular, looking at that matched loading dose phase is really important because the retreatment criteria in the aflibercept 8 milligram trials compared to the faricimab trials were different. So that initial loading phase data is really important. I think one thing I would point out is, you know, I was impressed that the results were significant when comparing faricimab and aflibercept 8 milligrams, but I think the effect size is also really important to consider. So when we look at, you know, the comparisons of faricimab to bevacizumab, ranibizumab, and aflibercept 2 milligrams, even though some of those weren't statistically significant when looking at CST differences, those differences were large. They were between 50 to over 100 microns. But when we look at the comparison with the aflibercept 8 milligrams, those differences were a little bit smaller when looking at anatomical outcomes and the differences, you know, 15 to 20 microns. And so I think that's important to keep in mind when looking at the study. Still very impressive, but I think it does still push me to want to really look at how these drugs perform in the long term in my own hands. And I also think that one limitation with sometimes comparing the trials to how things fare in the real world is that particularly in that aflibercept 8 milligram to faricimab comparison when looking at trial data, we're primarily looking at treatment naive patients. So, you know, I'm really interested to see how it will fare in my practice. And I'm still, you know, kind of trying to understand that, especially with aflibercept 8 milligrams since it's newer. So those are some of the thoughts that I had.
You know, Ted, I think I applaud you for doing something like this. I think it's so important to have raised the bar for our analyses, and to do something so complex to try to understand how these medicines fare against each other is so critical. I think Durga brings up some great points regarding some of the limitations of the study, but you know, truthfully, in the absence, as Durga mentioned, of a head-to-head prospective randomized clinical trial, I think there are always going to be some limitations to the analysis. And you know, just like everything, it needs to be taken with a grain of salt, but it does reflect some important data that were actually seen in some of the clinical trials. We look at the loading doses between faricimab and 2 mg Eylea, demonstrating superior anatomic visual outcomes in DME. In contrast, the aflibercept 8 mg and 2 mg data during that loading phase did not differentiate themselves too much. So, you know, a great study, really exciting. I think we have a lot to talk about with this. We're going to break for a short commercial break and then stay tuned as we dive into this a little bit further.
Support for this program is brought to you by Genentech, the makers of Vabysmo, faricimab SVOA. There's more to explore. Discover all the data at vabysmo-hcp.com. That's vabysmo-hcp.com.
Welcome back to AMD and DME applications in the retina practice. Before the break, Ted and Durga and I had a discussion regarding Ted's presentation, looking at a comparative analysis of different intravitreal anti-VEGF agents. So, Ted, anything more to add regarding your presentation?
Yeah, I thought that the point Durga brought up was really important about clinical efficacy versus finding some sort of statistical significance here. So I think, you know, we all work in the real world here. We all take care of a lot of patients with retinal disease, and having clinical efficacy, I think, is the most important thing for all of us. I think we can probably all agree on that. And, you know, I think one of the data points that did come out from our study here was that the comparative benefit of faricimab over the other treatment modalities during the study period was about 1 to 2 letters. So there was a benefit of about 1 or 2 letters, and we can have a chat about whether that's actually clinically meaningful or theoretically meaningful, and so forth. And then as far as the drying efficacy or comparative benefit from that, we did find that faricimab during that loading phase, that matched loading period, did improve about 13 to 22 microns across the analyses compared to 2 and 8 mg of aflibercept during that 12-week period. So, you know, I think on the whole, we did see that faricimab did, you know, have a trend towards slightly better vision, 1 to 2 letters. We can argue whether that's important or not. And about, you know, 13 to 22 microns of increased drying ability from the faricimab. You know, and I'll start with my, you know, from my standpoint, I think any additional drying ability, I think, is going to put you into a better position, I think, clinically with our patients. Now, will that translate into better function, visual acuity, durability long-term? I think it does, because I think if you're ending up in a better place or getting to that place faster with a specific agent, I think you're setting yourself and your patient up for better long-term results. But I'll pause there and have you guys chime in.
Yeah, I'll chime in. You know, Ted, I agree. I think that any type of drying effect is important and probably lends itself to better vision. You know, certainly from a clinical standpoint, when I see patients, what I lend more weight to is the drying effect or the anatomy and not necessarily the vision. You know, if I think about 1 to 2 letters, yeah, that may not be visually significant and or kind of, you know, visually significant. And if I think about 10 to 20 microns, you know, it's a small number, but it's an important number, especially as we think about these patients who enter these clinical trials and are often starting off better than kind of in the old, so-called old days when they might have had a lot more fluid or a lot worse vision. But yeah, I think for me, drying is most important. And I think that's what I would look at when I see patients. And that really strikes to me when I see these clinical trial, these comparative results. Durga, what are your thoughts?
I think those are all great points. I think for me, I'm primarily focused on drying for a few reasons. You know, I think vision and routine clinical care is not always accurate. So there are a lot of other factors going on in terms of how we measure vision in a retina clinic. The OCT is the OCT. So that's something standardized that we can look at. And to be honest, you know, in many practice patterns, we don't check vision at every injection visit. We may be checking it every few visits. And so the OCT is what we're really going off of. And I think another point, you know, that you brought up about that 13 to 22 micron number, one thing that is important is not all fluid is the same, right? And so if we're talking about getting rid of intraretinal fluid and that difference is really there rather than, you know, subretinal fluid, I think some of us will allow a little bit if it means the patient can get extended out further, then that matters. And so, you know, I think there's probably more to the story and these results are really exciting. One really nice thing about faster drying too is that the faster we can get patients dry, the quicker that we can extend them in a treat and extend approach, because, you know, patients are concerned about their vision, obviously, primarily. And then I think the second thing that they're concerned about is how can they really increase their injection interval. So I think that's important.
Yeah, I think, you know, there's been a huge unmet need in diabetic macular edema specifically for a long time, since the anti-VEGF era began. It's not like retinal vein occlusion or neovascular AMD where we expect completely dry retinas. I think we, you know, I think have come to accept the fact that we're never going to have completely dry retinas most of the time with DME. But maybe, you know, maybe that doesn't have to be that way forever. I think with agents like faricimab and other things that are on the horizon, there may be, you know, the potential for having completely dry retinas and DME at some point. So I think I'm kind of excited and hopeful about that.
I think that's a great point. And I think it's also really nice to just have more in our treatment armamentarium for DME specifically. You know, prior to this, if a few agents didn't work, we were thinking about steroids, and steroids don't, they work great, but they're not an option for everyone. You know, we have patients that have glaucoma. A lot of our DME patients are younger. They're not that excited about getting a cataract. And so to have these additional agents that do show very good drying effect in DME is important.
The point that I was going to make was just in reference to some of the studies that Genentech has come up with regarding faricimab. So faricimab being out for a year and a half, there have been some post-hoc analyses and so forth. And the same analyses have been done for other therapeutics. But one thing that I found really interesting was that in the drying of DME, it takes about a year for 50% of patients to achieve drying and in patients with DME. And I think one of the differences that you alluded to is just that when with patients with wet AMD or RVO, the drying is typically much faster. And I think for these DME patients, the drying just takes much longer. I'm not sure what that means, but I think it reflects the fact that this is a chronic disease. We need to chip away. And I think we may get used to tolerating some degree of edema, but I'm not sure if that's the right way. And maybe we just need to continue to chip away at their disease until we can get them as dry as possible.
Yeah, I think it also speaks to the kind of global nature of diabetic retinopathy versus the focal nature, I guess, of where the pathology is located, say in neovascular AMD specifically. And you know, maybe that analogy doesn't translate completely to RVO because a CRVO is also a global problem. Although the incident lesions, if very focal lesion, it's not the entire retina that's ill from a CRVO. But in diabetic retinopathy, the whole vasculature of the entire eye is ill. And so maybe that's why, at least the way I think about it, there's so much signal, VEGF or whatever you want to call it, that's being produced by the eye, it needs to be quenched by the agent of choice, right? And so, you know, a VEGF monotherapy probably doesn't pack enough punch to soak up all those particles of VEGF that are being generated by an entire eyeball that's sick versus a small CNV lesion or, you know, one blood clot that's in there.
Another important difference is that RVOs and their edema may be more of an acute process in terms of their presentation, as opposed to DME, where these patients are kind of more chronic. You know, their edema has a chance to develop and therefore becomes perhaps more refractory. You know, if we see a chronic RVO patient, oftentimes that edema may be more difficult to get rid of. But yeah, you know, I think it reflects an important aspect of DME, that it reflects a chronic disease, a systemic disease that we need to manage. And I really like Durga's point that Overall, what your study reflects is that we have an abundance of treatment options at this time, and it's really a great place for us to be in. We have anti-VEGF agents, we have an anti-VEGF and anti-Ang2 inhibitor, we have steroids, we have an abundance of options. And Ted, I think this is a great study to try to give us some insights as to how these therapeutics stack up against each other. So with that, I'll conclude. Thank you to the audience for listening to this first episode of AMD and DME Applications in the Retina Practice. Stay tuned for another episode.